just taking a moment to collect ourselves. Before we actually start the chanting, let's just bring our minds to rest first. Just letting our attention settle into awareness of our body in this present moment of awareness. In Buddha Dharma and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha Dharma and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha Dharma and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon. This imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. So I will do my teacher prayers, beginning with the four dharmas of Kampopa aspirations for this teaching. Dadan Samshan Tamche Loche Sudro Orzinji Laptu Sol Shalom Dudro Orzinji Laptu Sol Om Tupa Sol Orzinji Laptu Sol Tupa Ishe Suchar Orzinji Laptu Sol. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. And from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai ke dang lu dang nu jing he chubum da na mi ke nam dang dro wa kun ji dra ke di tsam par tam che ke di ra ki ju ten to. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And then the reminder for arousing bodhicitta. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings, whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So we've already brought our minds to rest. Let's just check in on that again. First, checking with our posture, making sure that we're basically straight and sort of in a sturdy, straight, grounded posture, but relaxed. Everything that's not needed for support, all our muscles that are not needed for support are just completely relaxed, maybe checking in especially with our jaw, our mouth, which where we hold a lot of tension. Taking a moment to relax and to tune into present awareness, this very precious present moment, letting go of all thoughts that arise, letting them arise, but just letting them go their own way without engaging or stopping them. Resting in open awareness, within which we will contemplate the four reminders. The precious human existence, we all know what that means, that's verse one. We just need to make use of it. We need to step into the boat, as Ken says. So maybe we could visualize ourselves stepping into that boat. And then remembering impermanence and death, that this is a limited time opportunity, and so we need to make use of it now and not put it off. So we're cutting the mooring and we're setting sail. And then remembering karma, the law of cause and effect that the Buddha taught, that what determines our fate in this and future lives is our own actions. Whether what lies in store for us is happiness, suffering, or liberation depends entirely on what we do. So we need to choose our actions carefully and make the most, the best use of all of our opportunities to act in thought, word, and action. And then finally, remembering the suffering of samsara. That there's no reliable happiness anywhere in the cycle of confusion. So there's no point in wishing for better samsaric circumstances, but we need to put our energy into freeing ourselves. So now we'll just follow our breath for a moment within the context of having contemplated those four thoughts and really turned our intention towards the Dharma. Just following the breath. And now we're going to briefly do the steps of ultimate bodhicitta, cultivating ultimate bodhicitta or wisdom, the four-step process to bring us to rest in the nature of mind. First, look at all experience as a dream. Meaning, in particular, all of our thoughts, opinions, judgments, fantasies, the same as a dream. No solidity, no solid reality to them. What does that feel like, letting go of that solidity and that certainty? Just resting in that. And then we turn our mind inward, our attention inward, to examine the nature of awareness, which is unborn. Who is it that's thinking that all of our experience is like a dream? Where does that reside? Does it have a location? Does it have a shape, form, or color? And just resting in that, not analyzing, but just looking and resting. Then letting even the remedy release naturally, which means letting go of any conclusions we may have reached about our experience or our awareness, leaving us in a non-conceptual state, which is the essence, the basis of everything. Rest in that. In the words of Zhongong Hongchao, let go and rest. Follow no train of thought, but rest evenly in a state of mind that is in itself clear and free of conceptuality. This is wisdom mind, to whatever extent we're able to rest in it. Primordial wisdom. And then without losing touch with that state, with the basis of everything, with our own awareness, we practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. So first, just tuning in again to our breath, just noticing the in-breath, noticing the out-breath, noticing any pauses, just noticing and not manipulating. Last week we started out with Pema Chödrön's instruction to begin Tonglen, which is to focus on the texture of the breath, the dark, smoky in-breath, and the white, refreshing light that's the out-breath. And that's optional. You can use that if that's helpful. Then you can focus on that, breathing in, dark, smoky light, breathing out, light or multicolored, refreshing light, whatever color is refreshing to you. Or you can just notice the in-breath and the out-breath without that additional visualization. Making it very relaxed, yet remaining alert. Continuing to let go of thoughts as they arise. And now we'll take a minute or so to notice whether we ourselves have any anxiety, any distress, any pain, anything that's bothering us, as we continue to notice our breath going in and out. Just feeling the texture of any distress, anxiety, upset, emotionality, and then breathing that in. Whatever there is, we just accept it, welcome it, breathe it in, right into our heart center, where we let it dissolve along with the breath. And breathing out to ourselves the antidote, whatever is needed to remedy. And we can continue to do this, really allowing ourselves to feel anything that doesn't feel right, anything that feels uncomfortable, physical, emotional, mental, breathing it right in, breathing out from our Buddha nature, relaxation, peace, comfort, happiness, awakeness. Doing this again and again, either on every set of in-breaths and out-breaths or every few, whatever is more comfortable. Eyes can be open or closed. And if you feel your anxiety or distress or discomfort being alleviated, that's fine. And if you don't, that's fine too. We don't have a goal in this. We're just noticing and accepting. And knowing that we have a storehouse in our Buddha nature of all the antidotes. And now expanding our intention and our visualization to include anyone who's having the same kind of distress or discomfort or pain that we're having. breathing in theirs as well as ours, letting it dissolve along with the breath in the heart center, our Buddha nature. Breathing out the antidote, whatever it may be. We don't even have to know what it is. Just know that we're breathing out relief. All humans, all animals, everyone in the hell realms, the hungry ghost realm, the gods realms, who may be having the same kind of suffering, we take theirs in too. Even if we can't see them, we know they're out there. Just like us. And now we expand our visualization even further to include all sentient beings in all realms of existence. Even if we don't know who they are, we don't have to think about that. Just knowing that all sentient beings have some kind of suffering, we aspire to take it away from them by breathing it in, letting it dissolve, breathing out the antidote. The vast visualization and a vast aspiration, and through our Buddha nature, we can do it. If individuals come to mind, then you can focus on them, always within the context of all sentient beings. And now we take a moment to think that we've really accomplished it, that we and all sentient beings are completely free from any kind of suffering, completely filled with happiness and completely awake at the level of a Buddha. And let's rest in that feeling for a moment. And then letting go of all visualization, all conceptuality, go back to following the breath. Just the breath, each in-breath, each out-breath. And that takes only a small percentage of our attention, and with the rest, we touch in again on open awareness. And we can let go of following the breath if we don't need it. And while you bring yourselves back to readiness for study and contemplation. All right, so we've done our prayers and our meditation. Does anybody have any questions or comments on verses 1 through 5 before we move on? If you do, you can unmute yourself. And I'm going to put the verses on the screen. But while I'm putting the verses on the screen, we have a silent pop quiz. Who did Tokme Zangpo have in mind as the audience for the 37 practices when he wrote it? Who did he write it for? So I'll let you think about that for a moment while I put up the verses. Okay, so the answer is he wrote it for himself. These are just reminders to himself. He was not trying to teach anybody. He had given up his position as abbot of a monastery and gone off to just live the rest of his life in relative retreat. He did have contact with people, but he devoted his life to practice and he just worked on himself. And we're very lucky that these verses got handed down, presumably by students of his. All right. So we're going to chant all the verses that we have through verse 6. We'll do verse 6 3 times as we usually do. Hopefully everybody can see them. If you can't, just unmute yourself and let me know because I can't see everybody now with the screen share. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free. for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my Dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rinpa clarifies, and certainty in Dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stay. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims, not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And today's verse, when I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane, constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane, constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And one more time, a little slower, and just letting ourselves focus on the meaning as we chant. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane, constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So let's take a moment. We're going to do not a silent pop quiz, but a silent reflection, not sharing with each other, but just looking at our own experience in relation to this verse. You know, regardless of any other questions that may arise that we may be discussing, is this true? Has this been true for us with our main teacher or any of our teachers that when we rely on them, through our work with them, have our negative behaviors and our faults subsided? Has our focus on negative behavior and faulty perceptions, has there been any change there? And has it promoted our, like, constructive, positive qualities? Has there been any growth there? Have we learned things? So let's just take a moment to reflect on that. So what we're going to do today is I'm going to compartmentalize a little more than usual. Just want to remind everybody that the teachings are recorded. So what I want to do is start out with the commentaries. And at 2 o'clock, approximately 2 o'clock, open it for discussion. We're not limited to just this week. I think this is a very deep topic, and it's a very, you know, current topic for us. And so we can take another week. We can take 3 weeks if we need to, but I think we can probably cover this in a couple of weeks. So don't worry. We're not going to get to everything today. There is such a wealth of resources on this, including, you know, not only the commentaries, and I'm bringing in a completely other commentary than we've looked at before because it had things in it that the ones we're using didn't have that I thought were really helpful. But we also have the four reliances, which I think is really helpful. We have Mingyur Rinpoche's article. I don't know if everybody's had a chance to see that yet, but I emailed to everybody today an article on Mingyur Rinpoche that appeared in Lion Roar's online edition as of today that directly addresses these questions. So if anybody has any comments on that format, please let me know. You can unmute yourself. But that's the way I'd like to do it today. So if you want to take a piece of paper, if you're afraid you're going to forget a question or a comment that comes to mind, just write it down. And by approximately 2 o'clock, could end up being 2:05. I don't think it'll be later than that. We will we'll have discussion. So I have a lot of materials here. First, then I have a list of, we're going to look at the four reliances first, actually. I sent that out and posted it on the study guide. And there are four reliances that the Buddha taught. He taught them in various sutras, and I sent you one of the sutras. And it's very interesting. It's actually not an easy conversation to follow, the Buddha's teachings on the four reliances, and I've only had a chance to look at it briefly so far. But the reliance that is related directly to this verse is just the first reliance, and that's the one we're going to talk about today. Rely on the message of the teacher, not on his personality. Literally, the Tibetan is more like rely on the teaching, not the individual. Rely on the Dharma. Actually, it literally says rely on the Dharma too, not the individual Kanza, which means a person, like a person. So sometimes it's translated as personality, sometimes as individual, most often as person. So, and I think that's a misconception, you know, that we may have had. There's like a whole, basically, it's a pitfall if our entire faith in the Dharma is based on the teacher. And Lama Norla himself has taught the four reliances many times. We need to develop our own independent relationship with the Dharma. We need to rely on the teaching and not on the person who's teaching it. So we can talk about that more in the discussion if people, you know, have any comments on that. But I think it's a really good thing to keep in mind. That is, we're never meant to rely entirely on the cult of the teacher, the personality of the teacher. And I think, to me, that's a really helpful thing to have in mind, even belated as it may be. there's a lot we didn't know. We're like pioneers. We here are pioneers. We're like the first generation of Western Buddhists of a certain kind. I mean, Buddhism has been in the West for longer than that, but it's our generation that really had access to the teachers and the teachings so close up. And we've had to forge our path and forge our understanding based on texts written in, say, the 12th and 14th centuries, for example, which presume a cultural background that we don't have. And as part of this process, we have been learning that Tibetans don't necessarily take the teachings as literally as we sometimes do. Like they know because it's been in their culture for centuries. So we're just learning. We're playing catch up here. And so the first reliance, always keep that in mind. Rely on the Dharma and not on the person teaching the Dharma. Meaning that's the primary reliance. Doesn't mean we don't rely on the teacher and have faith in the teacher. It's not negating that. We're talking about primarily here. If you have to pick between them, go with the Dharma. So next thing on the list is actually the jewel ornament. We're going to take a little quick trip into the jewel ornament, where the third of the three prerequisites, indispensable things to have in order to follow the path completely, is the spiritual friend. And so within this chapter, we have several lists of qualities that we should look for in a Dharma master. And I'm just going to read the lists from here. We're not going to spend time on it. But again, it's a checklist. And next week, we may look at the checklist in The Guru Who Drinks Bourbon, which is Jamyang Chensing Rinpoche's recent book on the guru and like how to figure out our relationship with the guru. He also has checklists of what to look for in a teacher and what not to look for in a teacher, like what teachers shouldn't have. But we won't have time for that today. But we're going to start with our friend, the jewel ornament, or ornament of precious liberation. So as we go through this list, let's just, if we have a teacher in mind, it could be Lama Norla, it could be another teacher who's a primary teacher for us. Do they have this? I think it's worth thinking about. First one, to have a bodhisattva's moral discipline. Second, to be learned in the bodhisattva scriptures, like to really know their stuff. Third, to have realization. Fourth, to be kind and loving to one's followers. Fifth, to be fearless. Sixth, to be forbearing, meaning to have patience. Seventh, to be of untiring mind. And eighth, to know how to use words, meaning to communicate well. So that's the list of eight qualities. That's the comprehensive list of things to look for in a Dharma teacher. There's also a shorter list from the Ornament of Mahayana Sutras that's cited in the Jewel Ornament, which is that their teaching is very broad-based because they've studied many things. Second, they can remove others' doubts because they themselves have superb discerning awareness. Third, their speech is worthy of recollection because their deeds are those of holy beings. And fourth, they teach the two natures, relative and ultimate. And then Shantideva boiled it down to two qualities. He said there's just two things you need to look for in a spiritual master. He says, even if it cost your life, never forsake a qualified Dharma master who is, number one, skilled in the meaning of Mahayana, and number two, maintains the noble bodhisattva discipline. So there's a couple of red flags in there. Now we know there's a couple of red flags we did not know. We are now going to turn to Ringu Tulku and very briefly read his commentary on that list. And he has some advice for us that I think is relevant to current concerns. So he says, the qualities of ordinary spiritual friends, they must first of all follow the precepts and vows of a bodhisattva. Second, they must have studied in depth the teachings of the path of the bodhisattva. Third, their understanding must be deep and not purely intellectual. They must have truly experienced the teachings. That's what Gampopa called realization. They must have realization. Fourth, they must feel sincere compassion toward all sentient beings. Fifth, they must be fearless and show a lot of courage, not only in their own actions, but also when they teach others. Sixth, they must be tolerant and patient with their students and their practice. And again, this is the same list as the jewel ornament, but with Ringu Tulku's, spin on it. Seventh, they must be tenacious and not allow themselves to be carried away by discouragement or disappointment. Eighth, finally, they must be capable of communicating effectively with students. He says, in certain other texts, such as the Mahayana Sutra Lankara, for example, four qualities are described. First of all, the teacher must be very learned and have vast knowledge. Next, he must have a deep analytical wisdom, which helps him conquer his students' doubts. Third, his conduct must be perfectly virtuous and honest, so that he truly deserves the respect and confidence of everyone. Fourth and finally, he must be able to point out problems, disturbing emotions, negative aspects of life, and the means to avoid them. The teacher who has all these qualities is an authentic spiritual friend. But he ends this section with a slight disclaimer. He says, and this is echoed in the commentaries and in Nyingma Rinpoche's article, finding a perfect master is without doubt rare and difficult. So if we find a teacher endowed with most of these qualities, we can certainly ask him or her to become our guide. Now, and we can talk about this when we discuss in a few minutes, I think some of these would be absolutely indispensable. You know, it's not like they just have most, but there might be one or two that, like, those would be stoppers if they didn't have them. So, but Rinpoche Thupi is telling us, don't be too picky in a way. If you find a teacher who has most of these qualities but isn't perfect, that's a perfectly suitable spiritual friend. Then he says, if he has but a few of these qualities, perhaps it is wiser to refrain. Anyway, it is important to remember that no matter how great the knowledge and qualities of the chosen teacher, in the end it is the student who must learn and practice. One's own studies and practice are the most important factors. Working our way down the list, we're going to just look at a couple of highlights from Dingo Chense's commentary, which is on page 76. And we'll look back at his paragraph in the previous verse as well. So I'm just going to pick out a couple of passages here. But starting at the beginning, to achieve liberation from samsara and attain the omniscience of enlightenment would be impossible without following an authentic, qualified spiritual guide, spiritual teacher. So that, like, we don't want to gloss over that point. We need a teacher. We really need a teacher, and Gampopa makes the same point. He says it's a prerequisite for following the path. And we're going to get into, in other commentaries, a little bit more of why that is, but it is pretty universally taught that we cannot reach full Buddhahood without a teacher. And I can say from doing three-year retreat, there are certain practices you really could not do. The six yogas, you could not do those without a guide who knows them well. So he says, such a teacher, an authentic qualified spiritual teacher, always acts, speaks, and thinks in perfect accord with the Dharma. Rinpoche Thupi did say maybe not always perfect. And Nyingma Rinpoche says the same thing. But this is basically the ideal. He shows you what you have to do to progress successfully on the path and what obstacles you will have to avoid. So did we get that? Did he show us how we need to progress successfully on the path and what obstacles we have to avoid? He encourages you to concentrate on practicing the Dharma above all and to do only what is virtuous and beneficial. He helps you give up all unsuitable conduct without hypocrisy, and he reminds you to be aware of impermanence and to stop clinging to samsara. Back to our metaphor. An authentic teacher is like the sail that enables a boat to cross quickly over the ocean. If you trust his words, you will easily find your way out of samsara, and that is why the teacher is so precious. Gampopa likened the teacher. He used three similes, and I don't know that I can bring them all to mind, but it's like you need a guide to guide you through unknown territory. You know, if you don't know where you're going, you need, he didn't use the word guide in both places, but I am, a guide to guide you through dangerous territory, like if there are bandits, which there often were in Tibet. And you need a captain to sail your ship through the currents. This is why we need a teacher. So with the teacher, we can set sail. I'm going to skip a bit down to the bottom of 76. Am I going there? I guess. All accomplished practitioners of the past attained enlightenment by following a spiritual teacher. They would start their search by listening to accounts of the doings of different masters. When the stories they heard about a teacher were particularly inspiring, they would examine his qualities. So those are the qualities that we just went through from a distance before committing themselves. And I want to say that in my own experience, I met Lama Norla Rinpoche in 1980, some people started with him in 1976, there really weren't a lot of teachers around to pick from. Now there's tons, but we didn't really know what to look for in a teacher, and we didn't have a lot of teachers to choose from. You know, you met a teacher who you felt could help you, and that's where you went. And I personally have no regrets. I feel like I got a tremendous amount out of it, but we'll address that in the comment period. Once they had complete confidence in him, after thoroughly examining him, they would go into his presence, serve him, and unpointedly put whatever instructions he gave them into practice. And that is the student's end, and that's something we have to each examine in ourselves. Like, did we hold up our end of the bargain, or do we hold up our end of the bargain with the teacher, which is to put into practice the precious instructions that were given? So I'm going to skip. Right. All right. I'm going to skip to the next page, 78. Just read one little passage towards the middle of the page. Even a few words of instruction from the guru can bring you to enlightenment. Therefore, pay attention and assign great value to each and every word of his teachings. Reflect on their meaning and meditate on them. So that's within the explanation of how we serve a teacher when we have one. But it's a really important point. That is what the teacher is for. And then he says, and we're going to delve into this in the next commentary, if you see your teacher as the real Buddha, enlightenment is not far off. So I encourage everybody to keep rereading the commentary on this verse in Dengo Chensi Rinpoche. Really, really take it in and internalize it. We're going to turn to previously unremarked upon commentary that I have used for many years. I don't teach from it generally because it's a Gelugpa commentary. It's by Geshe Jampa Tekchok. It's called Transforming the Heart. I personally think it's a very wonderful book. It's along the lines of Dingo Chense in that it's really a very thick book and a compendium of the whole path. I love the way that he explains things, and he does have some comments in here that we didn't find in Dingo Chense Rinpoche. So I'm going to read a little bit from this one again very selectively because in 10 or 15 minutes we want to be on to discussion. Geshe Jampa Tekcho, and this is edited by Thubten Chodron. People, I think everybody's probably heard of her. She's a Western nun like Pema Chodron, but she's in the Gelug. She is to the Gelugpa tradition what Pema Chodron is to the Kagyu tradition. A really effective Western spokesperson. In both cases, a woman. So that's like the credentials. That's the like credentials that we have. For like she can maybe lend credibility to Geshe Jampa Tenchok, whom we haven't heard of, but who is undoubtedly a great teacher. just looking at his biography, which I didn't do. His Holiness the Dalai Lama appointed him as abbot of Sarojama Monastic University in India, so that's a pretty good credential too. So he says, at the beginning of his commentary, he says, relying on good companions helps us and enables us to help others. Among good companions, the supreme is the virtuous spiritual guide or guru. We need to know the proper way to rely upon such a person, since devoting ourselves to the spiritual guide is the foundation of the path. By being around a virtuous spiritual friend for a long time, our faults decrease and our virtuous qualities continually increase like the moon growing full. That is like reflecting what the verse said. So here he clarifies that question that came up last week and which Dingo Chensi also addresses in chapter 5, that spiritual friend does not need to refer exclusively to the teacher, but it can also mean our Dharma community. He says, good companions also include our fellow Dharma students at our Dharma center or monastery. We listen to the teachings, discuss the teachings to eliminate doubts, and meditate and practice together. By supporting us along the path and encouraging us when we feel discouraged, our Dharma friends help us transform our minds in a positive way and progress on the path to enlightenment. Even if they do not have great positive influence over us, such that they cause our faults to decrease and our qualities to increase greatly, we are still inspired by seeing them get up early each morning to meditate, go to teachings regularly, and study and practice to the best of their ability. Their example gives us confidence that we can do the same. And I think of myself in that category, like I'm some kind of intermediate thing. I am definitely not like the kind of spiritual friend or teacher that's meant in these texts. We're talking, I mean, I go through that list of qualities and I don't have them all. We're working on them, you know, but I hope that like I can be in this category, you know, of someone who practices and supports the practice of others and shares with you like my limited understanding of the Dharma. So I'm skipping. Okay. Once we have chosen someone as our spiritual guide, we should rely on him or her properly so that we can derive benefit from the relationship. Properly relying on a spiritual mentor does not mean that we idolize him or her like a movie star, expect him to fulfill our emotional needs, or give up our wisdom with some romantic idea of surrendering to the guru. The purpose of the relationship is to increase our wisdom and compassion and to enable us to benefit ourselves and others. It is important to see our mentors as Buddhas because we will only profit from this attitude. I'm being very selective because of the limited time. By developing the confidence that regards our spiritual guides as Buddhas, by seeing our spiritual guides as Buddha, by choosing to see our spiritual guides as Buddha, then whether they are or not, we profit from the relationship in the same way as if they were. Just have to take a sec to check on my battery here. Yeah, okay, still good. And he's going to continue in this vein. He has some very useful things to say here. This practice of seeing the spiritual guides as Buddhas is done with those whom we have chosen to be our teachers. We do not have to think of everyone who is a Buddhist teacher as a Buddha. We can see our spiritual teachers as Buddhas because it is possible to train our mind to recognize and focus on their many good qualities and to think less and less about their faults until we don't notice the faults at all. And as Mingyur Rinpoche makes clear in his article, like when this kind of thing is said, it doesn't mean that they have license to do egregious things. But generally, you know, when we see them as a Buddha, it's a choice that we're making for our own benefit. And so if we see something that we consider to be a flaw, you know, sort of an ordinary kind of a flaw, like maybe they're not always the greatest teacher, or maybe they, you know, have some habit, like maybe they eat too much, or, you know, whatever it is, some kind of ordinary flaw, then it's okay to overlook that and still see them as a Buddha, because that helps our mind. That's how we train our mind. But as Mingyur Rinpoche makes clear in the article that I sent everybody, this doesn't apply, you know, when they engage, when they break their vows or engage in, you know, unethical behavior. He says, if we examine, okay, no, I'm going to skip that. He has lists of like, he has a whole section on how it's possible to see them as the Buddha, like what qualities, you know, in them enables us to see them as the Buddha. And I'm not going to read that, but I think you could make do with Gampopa's list or Rinpoche Tulpa's list. He says, when we have strong confidence, trust, respect, and gratitude for our spiritual guides, the path is generated more quickly in our mind stream. That is the purpose of developing confidence and gratitude. As mentioned above, gaining realization of these is difficult. When we feel that there is no mentor apart from the Buddha, and there is no Buddha apart from our mentor, that is when the two seem inseparable, then we have gained this realization. Well, while developing our faith and respect in our teachers, we must also keep in mind that if a teacher instructs us to do something which runs counter to the general teachings of the Buddha, we should not do it. If a teacher acts in a way that is abusive or unethical, we should not follow his example. In neither case do we need to get angry. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama suggests, we can keep a respectful distance from them yet still appreciate what they taught us that helped us along the path. In other words, we don't need to negate everything positive about the person simply because of one aspect of their character. And again, here he is talking about abusive or unethical behavior. Even that, according to Geshe Jampa Tegchok, we still don't need to harbor anger. That's something we each have to work out for ourselves. But, you know, remembering Gampopa's advice that anger is never beneficial, we could spare ourselves that if possible and keep equanimity and remember their good qualities. That's the advice here, is to maintain equanimity even if we feel they've engaged in egregious, you know, let us down in egregious ways. We can still maintain our own equanimity and we can still remember the good qualities that they had. Nevertheless, even for our teachers who are not our Vajra masters, it is helpful to see them as emanations of the Buddha and view them as working for the benefit of sentient beings. A positive attitude makes us receptive to what they teach and inspires us to practice, and we in turn reap the good results of practice. We cannot actually know if someone is a Buddha or not, but we can decide to view our spiritual guides in that way. So here again, he's making it clear that this is like a conscious choice that we're making. We say that the Dalai Lama, for example, is a Buddha, but how can we know for sure? We are not capable of knowing, but we can recognize the benefits of having this view and decide to adopt it. If we have a positive attitude toward us, and this is the last paragraph of this commentary, if we have a positive attitude towards our spiritual guides, we will accomplish what we wish. For example, if we think that the room we live in is cramped, dark, and airless, if that's what we focus on, we become unhappy. Thinking it is just right, nice, and spacious enough makes our mind happy. The room has not changed, simply our attitude has, but that makes all the difference. If we are unable to think of our spiritual guides as Buddhas, we can still consider them very important and precious. Even this is an excellent way to purify negativities, and for this reason alone, it is a very important practice. So that is all the commentaries. That was just a quick survey. We still have Ken McLeod's commentary, which if we decide to go on for another week on this topic, we can look at Ken's commentary. It doesn't really break any different ground. He makes a lot of the same points, but it's still very nicely put. So if you have it, you know, it's good to read it. And if we go on for another week, we'll look at that one. And the Mingyur Rinpoche article as well is a very good thing to read. I think it's very helpful. So it's 2:00. I'm going to unmute everybody. And if you have any questions, any comments, anything you want to share, then we can do that. Bearing in mind that we are recording the teaching, it always takes me a second to find the unmute button, but you're all unmuted now. So does anybody have anything they want to say?
I do. I only had a chance to skim the Mingyur Rinpoche article, and I couldn't really hear the English translations of what the Dalai Lama was saying very well. I'm struck at how I'm dealing with this whole situation with such strong compartmentalization that I'm very clear about how much I've learned and how much I've positively changed as a result of Ramananda's teachings. Right. And yet I'm appalled at the amount of trauma.
Yeah.
Trauma is the word that Mingyur Rinpoche used, actually, I think, in the article. You know, if it's trauma, it's not good. And it's so, I mean, I'm okay with it, but it's so odd to have this sort of wall between two things. It just is very peculiar, but it works for me, so I guess I'll go with it. But it is very strange.
Yeah. I think of it as cognitive dissonance. You know, just like it's two things that, for me too, I can't integrate the two things. So I just hold them. And I have both things. You know, I feel very, very grateful. I look back at my history, 37 years now with Lamanor Rinpoche, and what I got from him, between him and me, you know, and as his student, it's so beneficial. I don't know where I would be without it today. And yet the conduct is unacceptable. So, you know, I don't even try to integrate it now. But, you know, the question is, where does that leave us as his students? And Deidre?
For me, it was like my parents were really, really good people. But my father had extramarital affairs. And for me, it was like that. It was just like, it was more a betrayal than I saw, you know, in that way. But it never stopped me from having respect or love for my father or gratitude for all the things he did for me. It never diminished my relationship with my parents in any way. So for me, it was like that. I think having gone through it at an early age helped me kind of grow up with that idea that people are not perfect. That's all.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. I think it's a useful, really helpful analogy. Yes, Chet.
Hi. Well, I'm sort of new to all this. I haven't been around all that long and new to the practice and the path. But as you were talking, I started thinking about a couple of things, and I think I have a different reaction based on my own personal and professional experience. I was raised Catholic, and I've been in the monastery and a seminary. And so I don't look on any teacher as an absolute vehicle, a perfect vehicle. I just, you know, too much insider information.
Yeah.
So my expectation of a teacher is ultimately they're a human being, and if there is a path, a dharma, a truth that's in them, that's what I'm attuned for. And the rest of it to me is, I think the professional for me part is I'm a psychologist. And so I can tell you from sitting in rooms with people over the years that there is no perfect human being. And it's given me a lot more compassion. So when I listen to, when I look at this experience, I know it's been difficult for people, but I see compassion for everybody in it. I think everybody has been hurt. Everybody has been a victim. Yeah. And as you, as my teacher, since we've been on this Dharma path together, you know, I listen to you, and I listen for your wisdom and for your experience, and I take it and I think about it, but I also, to be honest, you aren't my only source. You know, it's interesting. I appreciate how you bring these other books in, because as we've been doing the Bodhisattva path, I love looking for other things, and I found the Dalai Lama's book on, so I've been co-reading this, which is just a different perspective at times from what you give or the other books give.
Which book is that you're reading?
It's his commentary.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, he did it back in 95, I think, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, because on this part, he says the way... Though it's all about the teacher, he says it's really about your path, and the best practice is your practice, regardless of what a teacher teaches.
Okay, thank you. Anything further, Chet?
I think you're a really good teacher.
Just don't check me off against the checklist. I do want to say you brought something up that I do want to share. And it's, you know, it's something that I'm not sure everybody's ready to hear this part of it. But when we were working with the Olive Branch, and I was like on the front lines of that for 6 months. I mean, I was right in the middle of all of this for 6 months, trying to do the right thing. Working with Olive Branch, they made that, actually, I'm not sure if it was them or if it was Jan Chosen Bays, she's the Zen priest who was the advocate for several of the women. We actually started off working with her, and then we decided we couldn't go with her. She actually was too big a case for her. So we ended up with Olive Branch, and she ended up working with some of the women as their advocate. But she said to us right at the beginning that everybody's a victim, even Lama Norla Rinpoche in some sense is a victim. And I think that might be very hard to hear if we have a lot of anger about what happened, but that's their perspective, having worked with a lot of these cases, is that in some sense everybody is worthy of compassion, whatever they've done. We could even say that about Hitler. Sorry, anybody who's, you know, like a direct victim of Hitler. There's like Buddha nature in everybody, and everybody deserves compassion, only because you know they're going to have to pay off their misdeeds. Whatever misconduct anybody engages in, like the worse it is, the worse the karma that they've collected. So compassion on that basis, even if no other. So anybody else have anything that they would like to say or ask?
Linda?
Yeah.
Is it a lack of, like some people would not be tempted by that. So the fact that you are, or one could be, is it a lack of like something, development, something?
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't speak to it really because I don't really know. But I, to me, it's inconceivable that Lama Norla set out to hurt anybody. I really cannot think of it that way. I think harm did occur. I think he has recognized that. I think it's a blind spot, and I think that there are reasons for that blind spot. And, you know, I've put a lot of time and I've read a lot of things now about this, about how this happens. And I just think it's a blind spot. I think, as Beth pointed out, everybody's human. We were not taught to think of our teacher as human. And I think that's a failing. I think that the way that it was presented to us in the West, without the cultural context that the teachers came from, they didn't know we didn't have the context. I really think that's a big blind spot. We interpreted things in ways that I think in Tibet people don't interpret them the same way. We have to interpret things literally because we don't have any other background. But I think there's whole cultural differences. There's, you know, I mean, one thing, and again, this is not in any way meant to excuse what happened. I 100% feel that it was wrong for these relationships to happen and that the onus is on the teacher who should have known better. But when I think of what Lama Norla, for example, and so many of these teachers went through in their early lives, I mean, they were really traumatized. They lost families, they lost their country. Really terrible things happened. Yes, Deidre?
That was something I wanted to bring up because I'm dealing with an elderly parent who has suffered some trauma, and I really see how it's affecting memory and decision-making later on in life. But I think we really should understand the whole person, and it's very difficult if you don't do any reading on the atrocities that they survived. It wasn't just about losing your parents or your homeland. It was about seeing slaughter in front of you and being a survivor amongst all those dead bodies. And it's just something I think for us is very, very hard to really understand and get.
Yeah.
Again, yeah. Not excusing it either, yeah. But just saying no the whole picture and what trauma does to people.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a teacher at the monastery a year or so ago, about a year, his name is just not coming to mind, but he knew Rinpoche in Tibet, and he said that, you know, we all know that Lama Norla Rinpoche was in a prison camp for 6 months, but he shared a lot of details about it, and this teacher said, Lama Karma Somten, as he was, he said that Rinpoche would never tell us, but there were atrocities. He told us a few details of like what life was like in the prison camp and what they were put through, and it was pretty horrible. So again, I just think it just helps give context to the picture, but still, you know, still, it's not conduct that is in keeping with the list. You know, the list of what we should look for in a Dharma teacher, I think. Yes, Marilyn.
On the cultural disconnect, I was thinking between Tibet and the United States or the West in general, I was thinking of how shocked I was when I used to work in Italy over the summers. And everybody, you know, everybody I knew was, that wasn't coming from the United States, the West, was Catholic. And they picked and choosed what the Pope said. They took some, they didn't take some. And I was just shocked because I had believed that if you were a Catholic, the Pope, whatever the Pope said was right, and you listened to all your priests and everything like that. And that may, to some extent, have been true in the immigrant, vast wave of Catholic immigrant communities to the United States. But in Italy, that just wasn't the case. It was sort of an analogy that they took it with what they wanted, and they didn't take what they didn't want, and we just didn't have that.
I think it even goes deeper than that, that different cultures have a whole different culture. You know, I mean, you're coming from your culture. One of the books that I'm reading right now, it's called Halfway Up the Mountain, and I can't recommend it wholeheartedly because it mostly relies on teachers that I would, like Western teachers, that I don't consider to be authentic teachers necessarily, but it's still got a lot of really useful stuff in it. It's about what enlightenment is and how you know when you're enlightened and what happens when people think they're enlightened and they aren't. And you know, it has this observation that that these teachers came to us out of a cultural matrix that was very complete. Like there was a complete context for religion that had been built up over centuries, like Catholicism in Italy. And when they came here, they didn't necessarily know that we don't have the same context. I mean, if we look at Lama Norla Rinpoche, he acted like he was in Tibet. You know, he didn't really get a lot of our culture. He dismissed it in the early years, like, oh, that's so stupid. He didn't understand that that's our culture. Like, we do that because that's our culture. And over the years, as he began to understand, like, that was a way to make him understand the behavior. So say, Lama, that's our culture. And he would say, oh, okay, you know, I get that now. It's not just some stupid thing, but that's the culture. And their cultural matrix, as it's called in the book, supported them and protected them in certain ways that they lost here. It's no longer clear how you operate in the gray areas. Again, I don't want to use that. I'm not trying to say that this wasn't clear. I think it even if it wasn't clear, it should have been clear. Now it should have been clear that this is something that we don't do. If someone holds a very specific vow, then it should be clear when that vow is being broken, but you get into all kinds of quicksand trying to analyze these things. So anybody who hasn't spoken yet have anything that they would like to say? Patrick?
A couple of things. One is that I think it was a red flag that Lama Norla's generation didn't really take to learning English. One of those things said that you look for is somebody that can really communicate with the student teacher. And that didn't happen, really, and pretty much by choice. And that was kind of, I'm still Tibetan, was the message.
Yeah.
And then the thing that I'm really upset about is the way that the Tulkus have been treated. You know, it's a generation gap among the Tibetans, even. Mm-hmm. Karmapa has spoken about how badly he was treated. Kali Rinpoche has spoken very strongly about how he was treated, and he's been ostracized because of that, as far as I can tell, from our own monastery. It's off the wall now. You know, his name is not on, you know, not there anymore. And then John Van Contrell the fourth, he left because of it, and the Karmapa said, well, I understand why he did, because he ripped these kids away from their family at 2 years old and put them in this patriarchal, hierarchical, medieval situation. And what do you expect, right? Mm-hmm. So that makes it hard. That makes it really hard for me to know how to just keep from strongly considering Menger Rinpoche as the role model. But am I making the same mistake by looking to him as a role model as I made Lama Norla as a role model? Just because he learned, I mean, he speaks my language, literally. etc. You know, it's really confusing where you know, especially with us hosting a center, what to do with that. You know, what how to describe to people who we are.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a period where things are not clear. You know, this is a really long process, I think, of things settling down again into sort of a new and clearer pattern. So I think we have to be patient with that process. But yeah, that's a good question. How do we know? And you also raise a question that I don't think you intentionally raised for me is like, does this conduct mean that Rinpoche is not a role model anymore? And for me, it doesn't completely negate his role modelness. You know, there's this piece of it that, you know, I can't go there, but as a teacher, I still feel like everything he gave me as a teacher is valid. And a lot of his conduct was in keeping with a bodhisattva. So I don't know, you know, again, like I think, Marilyn said at the beginning, I have to compartmentalize a bit. I'm not throwing out Rinpoche completely. I can't do that. Yes, Patrick.
Well, you've been able to really be, you know, you've really expressed that about Trungpa Rinpoche. You know, you've talked from his text many, many, many times, but then also talked in general, not about him, but in general, about how bad his behavior like his has been.
Right.
You know, and that's been
Put it in the same category. Yeah, I personally put it in the same category. And some people don't because he didn't keep it secret. But I don't see that the conduct is really so different. So, yeah, really good point, Patrick. Like, we still read Trungpa Rinpoche's books. We're not throwing out, you know, the Dharma that he transmitted. But I think it's, you know, it's a question. Does it invalidate it? And we go back, I think, to the first reliance. There too, it's like, you know, the teacher may disappoint us. You know, at best, the teacher is impermanent, which is I think why the Buddha taught that the teacher will not always be with us. So we have our own foundation of the Dharma, like the Dharma the teacher gives us. We build that into a foundation through our own practice.
I have a quick comment.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, this is Mark. But when the Dalai Lama said that he recognized that, he said Lama institution.
And he I'm said, sorry, oops, you dropped out for a sec.
Okay, he said Lama institution.
Right, yeah.
And he said that there's a feudal component to it.
Right.
I think is, you know, it's true. And it probably needs to be separated.
Right.
Thrown out, really.
I think that's our life's work, is to figure that out. Yeah, but go on. Sorry for interrupting.
Well, and if you look at what that is, in feudal society, you had the high people, and then you had the everybody else, and the everybody else were supposed to do exactly what the high position people said.
Mm-hmm.
And there really wasn't the opportunity for the lower position people to even question. So that could be just part of the culture that is kind of keeps this stuff going.
Yeah. And our culture definitely doesn't work that way.
Right.
So I think that's going to have to sort itself out. But again, we're the pioneers. Yeah. So we inherited this thing and we didn't know what part of it's like culture and what part of it's religion. And slowly over the last 30, 40 years or so, we've been working that out. But the teachers aren't always working it out. As Patrick said, you know, there's certain signs that they don't want to assimilate into this culture necessarily. They feel that, you know, they're bringing us the whole thing. But we have to do that work.
Right.
We have to do that work. Anybody else have anything that they'd like to say?
I don't know. I really feel like, too, that when I was shopping around for Christian teachers, because I left my Christian church, mm-hmm. I just kept seeing over and over again their falsivities, the things that didn't go along with my heart. And so I sat in front of the Tibetan Buddhism teachers or any of the Buddhist teachers, my heart always felt true. And I think that's what we need to do and not really focus in on the individual. And that, and we know the teachings are authentic. I haven't found one teaching that did not work, that when put into place didn't make that heart really say, yes, this is what you're doing.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. I think that that's a really great point. Yeah, it is, you know, again, it's what resonates with us. It's like, you know, we don't, one of the commentaries said we're not giving up our own innate wisdom in this process, just in a process of surrender to the guru, even though surrender to the guru is a way that it's presented. I think, again, there's a cultural component to that maybe that we're not getting, but we're not like checking our wisdom at the door. We have to keep our eyes and our hearts open and see what's true for us and what resonates for us. So thank you, Angela. We have a little over 5 minutes left. We can use a few minutes to meditate if we want, but we can continue the discussion all the way to the prayers if anybody has anything they would like to add.
Well, I'll just say one more thing. How difficult would it be to have said no to Lama Norla?
I'm sorry.
As a person, as a young woman who found the Dharma, found this incredible teacher who opened up my heart, how hard it would have been to have said no.
Yeah. Well, we say no pretty easily to his practice instructions. But absolutely valid question. And I like to think, like, knowing what I know now, being the age I am now and, you know, all of that, like, if he had approached me, I like to think that would have been the end of the relationship, but I don't think it would have been that easy. Yeah, I mean, that gets into the whole abuse of power question, which I think that there's no question it's abuse of power, because you have this power. How can people say no to you? Okay, great. So we feel like we covered this one well enough.
You did a dynamite job.
Well, we have the resources, you know, and I thought that the discussion went well. I mean, it seems to me that we've had a while to process this now. And while questions may linger, I see you, Deidre, while questions may linger for some of us and we may need to talk some things out more or process things more, I think it seems fairly settled. We've had a lot of time to think about this. Deidre.
I think it's actually been very beneficial, and I think, like, because we are pioneers in the Tibetan Buddhist Dharma in the United States, that it's going to help mature our own way of looking at the Dharma, and I think it would be really beneficial to even have everybody just send in a one thing, like how they feel about it, you know, for future practitioners to see, you know, I mean, I don't know, some kind of forum, like whether it's, you know, these online magazines or something like that, you know, it's just like to prevent people in the future from falling into the same stumbling block.
Yeah. I agree with you that, to me, it's been a teaching. I mean, I've described it that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the teaching I think that Rinpoche meant to give us. I really don't think it was intentional. But to me, it's like I feel quite liberated by this thing.
Yeah.
I feel for the women, and I feel for everybody who's been damaged by this, which is like our whole Sangha and the whole world, you know, and the Kagyu lineage. But for me, the first reliance, like I didn't get it before. I'd been taught it before. I didn't really get what that meant. Like, what does it mean? I didn't. There was a separation for me between the Dharma and the teacher until now. To me, like the ultimate teaching is like you really can't rely on any appearances, even the appearance of the guru. So, what does that mean? There, as Trungpa said many times, there is no ground beneath our feet, and we always thought there was. We didn't realize we thought there was, but we thought the guru was the ground. I think, well, for me, speaking for myself, and now I first reliance, and I go, even the guru is not the ground beneath my feet. You know, it's all been pulled away, and that is the teaching I think Rinpoche wanted us to have, but not in this way. Mm-hmm. But that's what I get out of it when I look at it for what positive effect I can get from this situation. So I think you're right. This is a learning experience for us, and it's a learning experience for the future. And I'm not sure what you're suggesting, if you're suggesting something in terms of us expressing ourselves in some form, but I think it's happening. I mean, it's happening out there. Mm-hmm. Not just us, but lots of sanghas. And that's one thing we learned is that, you know, we hired Olive Branch. We've already worked with any number of sanghas, like, you know, and other people are just several different consulting firms out there who work with sanghas, you know, all in all religions, but, you know, a lot of Buddhist sanghas too on this. So we're not alone, you know, in this thing having happened, this kind of trauma having happened, and we learn from it. But hopefully we learn from it and we're able to move on and see what is authentic and what is valid and continue to work with that. So it's 2:30. Does anybody have any other parting words before we do our dedication? Yes, John Renish.
Yep, just a question about the commentaries that we had today.
Yeah.
It was a pretty definitive statement about not being able to achieve enlightenment without a teacher, spiritual guide, guru, and that was so definitive that I couldn't help but think, well, the Buddha didn't have one, did he?
Well, that's a really good point. He did, actually. He did have a lot of teachers who brought him to the point where he could achieve his own realization. I think nobody gets realization from the teacher. We're all on our own in the end. But we need a teacher to get us to that point. I can't speak for the Buddha, but I do know that he studied with a lot of teachers. If you've, my favorite biography of him is, and it's a short one, it's called The Awakened One by Shirab Chudzin. And you see, he did study with teachers, and he exhausted what he felt they had to give him, and he knew he wasn't there yet. So he kept going, and then in the end, there was no teacher to teach him more, so he had to work out his own liberation, as he advises us to do. I mean, that was his final advice, right? Work out your own path. Work out your own liberation. But based on what you've gotten. But that's a consistent teaching throughout Buddhism, is that you can't do it completely on your own.
Okay, great.
Well, also there is the Buddha inside you, right? There's a lot of people, especially in America. So I think that's also when you start to meditate and see how abusive, or at least I have found that myself, how abusive I can be. You're also, I can be a bad teacher as well.
Yeah.
Good teacher.
Yeah. Yeah. The guru is meant to be a reflection of the inner guru. The outer guru is just to reflect to us the inner guru. And I think we often don't realize that. We don't quite get that piece of it. I think we do now. Thank you, Angela and John. Yeah. Okay, I think we're going to have to stop here. We're, you know, sorry if anybody is inconvenienced over a bit, but I think it was a really good discussion, and I really appreciate everybody's contribution. Okay. Dedicating the merit of this study and discussion and meditation to all the enlightenment of all sentient beings. This merit may it win omniscience. Defeat my false, the enemy, and from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri, betraying myself in their example. I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha. This dedication please fulfill. Letting our minds come to rest again, just resting in vast, spacious, open awareness that can encompass every kind of experience, every kind of doubt, every kind of question, and contains the entire path.